Translation. After creating the material substance, the Lord Vasudev expands himself and enters into it. And although he is within the material modes of nature and appears to be one of the created beings, he is always fully enlightened in his transcendental position. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The living entities are separated parts and parcels of the Lord, and the conditioned living entities who are unfit for the spiritual kingdom are strewn within the material world to enjoy matter to the fullest extent. As the Paramatma, an eternal friend of the living entities, the Lord, by one of his plenary portions, accompanies the living entities to guide them in their material enjoyment and the material conditions and becomes witness to all activities. While the living entities enjoy the material conditions, the Lord maintains his transcendental position without being affected by the material atmosphere. In the Vedic literature Shruti, it is said that there are two birds in one tree. One of them is eating the fruit and of the tree, while the other is witnessing the actions. The witness is the Lord, and the fruit eater is the living entity. The fruit eater, living entity, has forgotten his real identity and is overwhelmed in the fruitive activities of the material conditions. But the Lord, Paramatma, is always full in transcendental knowledge. That is the difference between the super soul and the conditioned soul. The conditioned soul, the living entity, is controlled by the law of nature, while the Paramatma, or the super soul, is the controller of the material energy. Om Iganti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Shri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastacha Deshitayane. So in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, this point is explained that Ekam Stena Stito Jagat, this is how the Lord enters into this material world. He's explained to Arjuna in the 10th chapter about his opulences, specific opulences, because if we want to know how powerful a person is, we start to relate his activities, and this is how we can understand his greatness. So in the same way, in the 10th chapter, it's actually explained as being more important than the 9th. And so that's like, it doesn't always seem to be the right, what can you say, it doesn't seem to be, you know, the 9th chapter is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, and yet after the 9th chapter it's explained that more important knowledge, and so we can't really understand the 9th chapter until we understand the 10th chapter, until we understand Krishna's supreme opulences, then we can start to appreciate the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this way it's more important. And so he says, so he starts to say how he is the essence of prominent things in this material world, like of bodies of water, I am the ocean. You know, of fish, I am the shark. I mean, everybody will go swimming. You know, if there's like a few trout in there, or a few herrings, or any other types of fish. If there's a few, you know, we won't be bothered. So what? But if there's a shark in there, definitely we'll think twice. In this way we can understand how Krishna is relating to us, how Krishna is important. So yeah, Krishna enters into the material world, and with a fragment of his self. This super soul is generated from Krishna himself through, you know, the quadruple expansion. And this quadruple expansion, this first quadruple expansion called the Chaturvyuha, is maintaining the whole spiritual world. And then from Shankarshan, out of those quadruple expansions, comes the second quadruple expansion through Narayan. And then the second quadruple expansion is maintaining the whole material world. So we can see how Krishna is gradually expanding himself. And then through that second Sankarshan comes Mahavishnu. He creates the whole material elements, the whole material substance, and he enters into each particular universe as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. And then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu then expands himself as Shiradakshaya Vishnu to enter into all the different elements and all the different living entities. So in this way, Krishna's very good at delegating. If we were as good at delegating as Krishna is, we wouldn't have any problems. You know, he delegates so nicely that he can just play his flute. Actually, one of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's, was it his godbrother or his one of his disciples? I think it was one of his godbrothers, weren't it? Yeah, I can't remember now. I think it was, it was one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. He was German, and he was a little bit more thoughtful than most people, and he went searching for the Supreme Lord, and he went to different situations in India, Lord Shiva, he was worshipping Ganesh, all these different deities, and eventually he saw a deity of Lord Krishna, and he said, "This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead," because he was just actually enjoying. And so if we want to find out who's the boss, usually if he's a good boss, what will he be doing? They're probably playing golf or something like that, because he's delegating. So Krishna's the expert delegator, and he delegates through the super soul expansion. And the whole purpose of material creation is to, you know, understand that he's different from us. Now this is a difficult thing to understand. How can anybody be different from me? You know, in the material world, Atmanam Manitejaka, everybody else thinks that everybody thinks like them. And so when we think about, you know, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we may not be so, you know, might feel a little bit of suspicion. I don't know, I read this in the Bhagavatam, you know, but, you know, I'm not sure. You know, if we were completely sure, what would we do? If we were completely sure about Krishna's position, there'd be no option. We just surrender everything. But because, you know, there's a little bit of, I don't know about this, it's this, you know, conditioning. And therefore we see Krishna through these, you know, tainted eyes, the modes of nature. And therefore we superimpose Krishna's situation on us. So the whole purpose of spiritual life is to get rid of this conditioning. You know, by nature we're full of happiness, full of bliss, and it's only this misidentification, this misunderstanding about Krishna's position that is stopping us from going forward. You know, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's Maharaj Kulashekha, at the end he says that he surrendered in, what was it? How long was it? How long did it take him to surrender? Maharaj Kulashekha. Oh, was it Katvanga? Katvanga. Maharaj Katvanga. In a second, in a moment. And then Prabhupada writes in the purport, it's just a matter of accepting the fact. And one of my worst subjects at school was English. You know, if anybody got anything wrong in English, it was me. And so when I read this, I hadn't got the intelligence to tie the first sentence up with the second one. I thought, what's this fact I'm supposed to understand? And then I asked this devotee, and he read it. Says, it's the fact that that Krishna, that we can surrender in a moment. That's the point. He's saying that we can surrender like Maharaj Katvanga in a moment. So this is the point, that we can do that if we understand Krishna's position. So anyway, I'd just like to change the tact a little bit. Maybe we'll come back to this later. We're talking about how Krishna enters into everything. This is the first one. And this is the whole subject matter. And we're just laying the surface there. But the second part of this purport, it talks about two birds in a tree. I was in Vrindavan maybe 10 years ago, and I was at the Russian ashram. Does anybody know where that is? It's just, you've got the MVT, is it MVT? Mayapur Vrindavan Trust, and then just a bit later, further along, towards the Goshala. And then there's on the right, on the left, there's it was green and cream building. So that's the Russian ashram. I was walking on the roof there. And this is like years and years later. I read this purport in the Bhagavad Gita about these two birds in a tree. And in the old Bhagavad Gita, what is there? Does anybody remember the old Bhagavad Gita? I don't know whether it's still in there. But there's two birds in a tree. Has anybody seen that? What colour are they? Are they? Well, they may be actually, but I remember yellow, red, and green. That's what I remember. I might be wrong. Is that right? Has everybody seen that? And I thought, and at the time, it didn't quite click. I thought, why have they put these coloured birds in this tree? I've never seen anything like it. I mean, in Watford, you don't get birds that colour, do you? So I was thinking. Anyway, I didn't think anything about it. Then, like 20 years later, I'm on the roof of the temple in Vrindavan and on the top of this ashram, and there it is. There's two parrots flying along, and then they went into this tree. I thought, oh, that's what it is. And I thought, wow, I have to come all the way to Vrindavan to get this realization, to know what the Bhagavad Gita's talking about. Maybe we should, what we should do, we should get some parrots transplanted in England. What do you think? Then everybody will understand. That's what to do, isn't it? Is it? We'll have a lot of parrots, and we'll breed the parrots, then everybody will understand the Bhagavad Gita. What's the problem? So what we're talking about here is, we have to be relative. I mean, Prabhupada, I'm not saying Prabhupada was wrong. He just maybe told his editors. He may have done that when he was in India. I'm not knocking Prabhupada, But what I'm saying is that, to me, that wasn't relative. And it threw me a little bit. And so, in this movement, when we're going to have to tackle a little bit now. We have to be relative to the time, place, and circumstance. And this is, immediately I read this report, it brought that to mind, that when somebody reads this, they may actually find out later when they go to India what it means. But so it's important that we're always ready for changing the situation, and then we can always be relevant to people. How do we know when we're not being relevant to people? What happens? When you look into the face, what happens? They just glaze over, don't they? They glaze over. So, by preaching breeds a mood of knowing how to preach in every situation. When we meet people and we speak to them, especially book distribution, it means we see their reactions, we hear from them, and we start to, even unconsciously, develop a whole psychology how to deal with different people in different situations. So Prabhupada was right, this movement, we've just had the book marathon, this is one of the easiest way to test the pulse of society. So just coming back to the point is that this verse is saying that Krishna is different from us. Misunderstanding of Krishna's actual position means it's difficult to actually relate, be relevant. It's different to relate to Krishna. It's different to understand you know, how we should reciprocate with him and how to make advancement. This is holding us back. For most devotees who've been practicing for a few years, then, you know, we accept Krishna's position. But for a newcomer, it may be a little bit different. And so, you know, Parikshit Maharaj, when he was speaking to Shukadev Goswami, they'd just been talking about the demons who'd been killed by the demigods, been slaughtered by the demigods. And Parikshit Maharaj could understand that all the people in the assembly there, they weren't actually all devotees, they were different types of transcendentalists. You know, you've got Moonis, they're always contradicting one another. You've got the impersonalists, Mayavadis, you know. So they were, some of them were devotees, obviously. But he realized they would need a better explanation, and so he asked Shukadev Goswami about, well, how is it possible that, you know, Krishna was, what's the word, biased. No, that's not the word, is it? He was favourable towards the demigods and not towards the demons. And so, you know, Shukadev Goswami said, I've already told you before, well, I'll tell you again. And he started to explain that, you know, the Supreme Lord is not controlled by the modes of nature. That's the difference. And because he's not controlled by the modes of nature, and we are, it's difficult to understand his transcendental position. He says, from our point of view, like we were saying earlier, we think Krishna's like us, so it breeds some misunderstanding. And then we see that something like this happens, where he's favouring one side against the other, and we may actually even think that, you know, it serves the demons right, you know. Maybe it does, but with a deeper understanding, we can understand that Krishna is seeing everybody from a transcendental position. He's not affected by these lower modes of passion and ignorance, and therefore he sees properly. And when he's seen properly, when we see properly, then we can understand things in the mode of goodness. And from the mode of goodness, we see on the platform of the soul. And so Krishna's always seen from that situation. And therefore we can understand that whatever situation we are in, if there's, whether it's difficult or whether it's you know, we enjoy that situation, that it's still Krishna's mercy. He's treating the demons and he's treating the demigods in one respect exactly the same. Why? Because he's wanting to benefit that particular living entity, and he sees what that living entity needs in order to actually become Krishna conscious. But externally, from a person who's in the modes, then he'll see that actually he's favouring one and not favouring the other. And so, you know, Krishna's very kind. Krishna's very very pliable to our needs. So he's all, the whole philosophy of the Vedic philosophy is what we call inclusive. Is that right? Is it an inclusive philosophy? You know, right down to the hellish planets, there's a chance for a person to become purified. So he's including everybody. And so it was the 27th of December. And that's one day after, you know, in the Christmas holidays in this country, the 25th is a big day, isn't it? That's where everybody's building up to, yes, Christmas is coming, Christmas is coming. And then the next day is, what? Next day is Boxing Day. This is another big day in the calendar. And then after Boxing Day, it's like, it's not so prominent, is it? You know, or it didn't used to be. So I was thinking, I'll go home and visit my parents after these 2 days. Then, you know, I won't get caught up in the euphoria or spoil their Christmas, you know what I mean? So I went on the 27th, and I made a mistake, actually. Nowadays, it lasts for longer. And I went I went in the room to speak to my brother, and he was watching one... it was a documentary about the James Bond series. And so I didn't get into it too much, but, you know, when once that's on, it's like... And for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I was talking to him, watching this series, and actually it was quite eye-opening, because it explained the author of all these different books. And I could see that the author, he was trying to fulfill something he couldn't do in his life. And I think that's everybody in this room, isn't it? We're all trying to fulfill something which actually it doesn't work out. Can everybody identify with that in the material world? We want to be something that we're not. And I could see that this author, he was actually a spy. He was in espionage in the Second World War. And he wrote while he was in the war, if I ever get out of this war alive, I'd like to write a book. And he actually got out alive. Not many did, but he got out alive. And then actually his wife said, as soon as the war finished, he actually lost himself. He'd been caught up in this. For him, it was like a fantasy world. It was something he wanted to do and wanted to enjoy. And as soon as we were out of it, he actually completely lost himself. And then he remembered that he wanted to start writing books. And so he started trying to write books. And eventually started to get, you know, encouragement. And he was thinking about writing about what he used to do. And his wife said what he wanted to write about is something he couldn't be. And so he started writing. And then he saw this name in this other particular book, James Bond. And he superimposed that on his character. And he started writing the books. And then he was really enlivened again. He was putting things into that book that he couldn't actually fulfill in his particular career as an espionage agent. And then, you know, then he got other people involved in it. Then he got others involved. And everyone that got involved in this particular series, they became enlivened by the idea, and it became their dream. It became their dream, and everybody bought into it. And then another thing I actually realised is that there was one particular one of these artists who took, there was four or five people who took this particular role. He said the first one is the one that everybody identifies as being the best. Right? So why is that? For those who don't know about this series, you're not missing anything, don't worry. We've still got the philosophy out. Why was he considered to be the best? Eh? It's original. The original is the best, is that right? When it's original, it's the best. You can't improve on the original. Right, so that's... Any others? Is it unique? In what way? Oh, good. Carry on. He put his own style into the acting. This is actually half the answer. But what was that style? I only watched it for 10 minutes, by the way. And, and in this style, it showed in the early days that in the films he was very happy-go-lucky and flippant. Nothing bothered him. It was like, nearest thing to transcendental you'll ever get. You know, he was in a situation where his life was at stake and impossible odds, and all of a sudden he'll get out of it, then he'll shoot a few people and he'll crack a joke. You know what I mean? Who does that in this material world? And everybody were in ecstasy when he used to do this. So who does that remind us of? Krishna. You know, everybody wants a hero. And he was everybody's hero. Even though we can't be that, we're enlivened when we see somebody. They're not affected by this world. You know, there are six opulences, is that right? And what's the most powerful one? Renunciation. They're all powerful, actually. I'm not sure which one. But for me, you know, somebody who's renounced, it beats all the others, doesn't it? He doesn't need money. He doesn't need the opposite sex. He doesn't need fame, you know. And so this is what was attracting everybody. And so we're all looking for that character, Krishna. And so this is the whole purpose of devotional service, is, you know, to meditate on the Supreme Personality of Godhead in everything we do, and start to understand that person. If we meditate on Krishna, then Krishna will reveal himself. If we don't meditate on Krishna, it's difficult for him to reveal himself. This is one point anyway. So yeah, the duty of all devotees is to, you know, inject this. Actually, I got a lot of faith from just watching this little snippet. It's not like I'm going to do that regularly, but you know, I did get a lot of actually faith from this. I thought, wow, this is what everybody is looking for, and everybody was really attracted to this program because it's like their hero. So yeah, we have to inject the same faith in people. Unless earlier in the class we were talking about relevance, being relevant. So somehow we have to be relevant with society. You know, to use things which are in society now and attract people to Krishna is what we need to do. You know, because everything's in a catalyst, isn't it? Unless we put a wrapper around something, it's difficult for people to actually accept. And so, you know, a devotee's first, or one of his primal things is when preaching, is to inject faith in the person. And first thing is that we become enlivened about devotional service. And then that person automatically sees that in us. But the second one is, we were saying earlier, when we actually meet somebody, we can start to see where they're coming from and present things in a suitable way. You know, why is it the devotee was so important? Because, you know, in the Madhuri Kadambini, it explains that, you know, bhakti is a process of which is actually being passed on from one person to another. We're passing on bhakti, faith, beginning of bhakti's faith. And, you know, Krishna, he doesn't interfere with that, according to Madhuri Kadambini. Ultimately, he has the ultimate say in everything, but he doesn't interfere with Bhakti Devi. Bhakti Devi is, you know, expansion of Srimati Radharani, who's non-different from Krishna. So Bhakti Devi is also independent. And so, but it says that the devotee who's carrying this bhakti within the heart, then he can give devotional service. We cannot give it unless we can't give something we don't have. And so, you know, to understand what society means, what society needs, and how to administer devotional service or bhakti to society is also bhakti. It's also, you know, thinking about the welfare of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna's very concerned that the living entities are actually delivered from their situation. So when a devotee is using this facility, the material energy, in an appropriate way for attracting the conditioned souls, then this is also devotional service. So I was going to go into more, but I don't have much time. I was going to talk about the seed verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. How this point about Krishna being different, Krishna expands himself into the material energy. No, we can't do that. And because Krishna is different, then there's actually, Bhagavad Gita says, because Krishna is different from us, then there's devotional service takes place. And so the seed verses of the Bhagavad Gita are specifically mentioned in this point. There's a whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam are mentioned in this point, that, you know, we have so many different pastimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam, but they're all coming down to this one point. And in the beginning, in the first seed verse, it says that, you know, in the beginning there was nothing but Krishna, now there's nothing but Krishna, in the end there's nothing but Krishna. And then it talks about Mayavad philosophy, understanding the difference between the servitor Krishna and Krishna himself. You know, the single eye and the, what is it? The dual eyes. Or the predominator and the predominated. And then it's a bit philosophical, this, so you'll have to be a little bit patient. And then the second verse, it talks about how Krishna is reflected into this material world. It's like the sun. The sun is reflected into the material world. But does it have the same effect as the sun itself? He says, so, you know, the only way we can understand Krishna is by Krishna's mercy. Is that right? Is it anything that we do? Maybe it's something that we do as well, but ultimately it's Krishna's mercy. And he gives the example of the sun. Yeah? The sun. Do we need a candle to find the sun? I know it's there somewhere. And you no, the sun's self-effulgent. So in the same way, Krishna reveals himself to the devotee. So Krishna's different. He's self-revealing. The third verse, it explains that Krishna enters into everything, but doesn't enter into everything. Just like, you know, the universe elements enter into the universe, but they don't enter into the universe. So can anybody explain this? How the universe elements enter into the universe, but they don't enter into the universe? Because, you know, I've got my theory, but it's... I've got my theory. But I was just thinking that actually the universe are the material elements. Aren't they? The universe is the material elements. So they're already entered. Maybe that's the answer. But it says that Krishna also enters into this material world, but he doesn't enter into it. Mayata Dhamidam Sarvam Jagat Avyakta Murtina Matstani Sarvabhutanin Naham Teshu Avashtitaha. He says that Krishna, same as we were saying earlier, he enters into it by his energies, and he's different from it by his personal personal self. And then the last one, the last verse of the Chatur Sloki of this Srimad Bhagavatam. It's just explaining the point that we've been making through this class, that, you know, we should search after the Supreme Personality of Godhead in all time, in all circumstances, both directly and indirectly. So this is our main duty in this particular movement, is to see that actually everything can be related to Krishna, and everything can be used to remind people of Krishna. And if we think along those lines, we don't actually misuse anything. Okay, we can stop there. Has anybody got any comments or any questions?